ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher Skase. Young, handsome, entrepreneur. He finds epic success in the 80s.
He came with that cowboy energy. He was doing big things.
Skase becomes a media mogul.
He outbid the legendary Rupert Murdoch.
His empire teeters, but he outfoxes them all. I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want you to imagine that you are on a hike. The path winds uphill ahead of you. There are trees all around you, these long limbs swaying in the breeze. You make it to the top of the hill, and looking out in front of you is just the most incredible view, right? Then suddenly, your chest feels tight. You try to take deep breaths, but you can't get enough air in your lungs. Then you reach into your pocket and you take a puff on a small blue device. And just like that, you can breathe again. That small instrument, the asthma puffer, it is quite literally a lifesaver. But it's had a very long and frankly quite weird history, going back thousands of years, to become that portable pocket-sized thing you know today. But there was one moment in the 1950s when a family sat down for breakfast that changed the trajectory of that device forever.
And all of the work that we do today would never have happened if it weren't for that one moment at the kitchen table.
I'm Mark Fennell. And this is the story of how one throwaway comment from a teenager changed the way asthma was treated forever. And no one saw it coming.
So people think of asthma as a disease of the modern industrialized world, but actually asthma's been around as long as people have been around. And we've had historical records of asthma treatments going back over 3,500 years.
So this is Dr. Daniel Duke.
I'm a senior lecturer in mechanical and aerospace engineering at Monash University.
And you might be wondering, why is an aerospace engineer talking about asthma? And you know what? That's a fair point. Daniel does have a connection to this story. It's amazing. We will come to it later. For now, though, you just need to know that when Daniel gives lectures, he talks to his students about invention and creation.
And, you know, we're teaching students and we want them to design and invent new products and come up with great ideas. And this story is like one of those stories that just encapsulates the truth of how inventions happen. In fact, inventions happen when you have well-educated people in the right time, at the right place, and when all of the jigsaw pieces come together, people will put things together and come up with fantastic new ideas.
And that is exactly what happens in this story. But before we get there, we're going to have to go back in time, like thousands of years, because there is a very weird history to the treatments for asthma.
So people discovered thousands of years ago that certain plants, when you burn the leaves, would produce smoke that would relax your airways. So, for example, in ancient China, ephedra, which could be taken as a tea or even as a, like a type of tablet, contained ephedrine, which is a modern medicine that we use in hospitals, and that was used also in the Roman Empire. And the cool thing is, back then, we have records of Pliny the Elder from like 20 to 70 AD recommending mixing ephedra with red wine as a remedy for asthma. He also made a whole lot of other recommendations that probably weren't very good medications, like crazy things like mixing the blood of wild horses, bear's gall mixed with water, or even millipede soaked in honey.
I've had all these cocktails, by the way. I definitely have. Yeah. All of them, each and every one of them.
So people were mixing all different kinds of leaves and plants and ingesting them or inhaling the smoke of them for thousands of years. And some of these, like the leaves of different plants in the nightshade family, these were really toxic. And so you had to be pretty careful you didn't overdose on them. Some of them, you know, included drugs like atropine, which are like emergency room drugs used in hospitals now. But people were inhaling smoke containing these drugs all the way back in ancient Greece and Roman times.
So inhaling smoke was a big part of treating asthma for a long time. Then you fast forward to the Industrial Revolution, and all of a sudden there are these new treatments, including the very first inhaler.
So in 1778, a guy called John Mudge invents the world's first inhaler. And because he's got a bit of an ego, he calls it the Mudge inhaler. And if you look at this thing, it's basically a beer stein with a hole in it, right? So he gets a pewter tankard. He goes to a pewterer who make these, you know, metal beer steins with the lids that close on the top. And he gets a hole put in the top. And you put water in it that makes some steam. And you might put a bit of opium or some other medicine in there. And you inhale the steam that comes through. And you tuck it under your arm to keep it warm and huff on the steam. And it was the first sort of commercially sold inhaler. And these were used all the way through the 19th century, quite popular in England.
Right. Okay. And I'm just looking at pictures and it does quite literally look like a beer stein with a sort of a lid and a hose through it. Would it have been effective?
For a short while, yeah. The problem is that you put steam in it, it cools down pretty quickly. And so you'd have to keep refilling it all the time. So part of the problem with a lot of these treatments is that if you had really bad asthma, you really couldn't go anywhere. You had to keep refilling the thing and, you know, you'd probably be housebound.
Which is not ideal. You fast forward another 100 years or so, and then we get the first portable inhaler.
In order to make this, you'd have to have a sterilised, typically glass container that you would fill with the liquid, and you'd have to put steam or air through it using a series of pipes and tubes, and you end up with all these fantastic sort of steampunk looking devices with these, you know, copper and metal tubes and strangely shaped glass bulbs, all kinds of odd things. But there were so many different kinds and shapes in, you know, different places around the world, and everything was almost custom made. You'd go to a pharmacist in your local town and that you couldn't, you know, there was no standard design. People would just cobble these things together, and there were hundreds of different shapes and styles, and everyone had something different.
So when you hit the 20th century, we start to get all kinds of wild treatments. And there's this one here that I, from the moment I looked at it, I just sort of started shaking my head. But walk me through the invention of the asthma cigarette.
Okay, so this sounds like a complete contradiction in terms, right? Smoking to make your lungs healthy. Around the 1880s, just before the turn of the century, cigarettes are really in vogue. And cigarette manufacturers start putting these different herbs, which the smoke can relax your airways, they start putting these in medicated cigarettes and they market them as asthma cigarettes. And they're actually quite effective. Of course, over the long term, they're really bad for your health, right? We know how dangerous cigarette smoking is. But, you know, in the short term, on hours or days, it would relieve your asthma symptoms. And these became really popular across Europe and the US and China.
And the French novelist, Marcel Proust, he used an asthma cigarette, didn't he?
Yeah, he had really bad asthma since he was about 9 years old, and he would have terrible asthma attacks. And he tried all these things, opium, caffeine, iodine, even morphine. He had his nose cauterized to try and reduce his asthma attacks. They tried all kinds of things. He tried having a milk diet. And he tried relieving all of these symptoms by visiting, you know, health spas and resorts to recover. The problem was at the time, people didn't really appreciate that asthma was an inflammatory disease. They didn't know what it was, and they thought maybe it was some kind of, you know, psychological condition. And if you went off to the health spa and had a relaxing weekend away, it might get better. But for Proust, it didn't.
And actually, we know what Marcel Proust's asthma attacks were like, because he wrote about them in these letters to his mum.
Ma chère petite maman, I'll drop the French here to spare you. Misery of miseries, or mystery of mysteries. That's the title of a chapter in one of Dumas' novels, which would apply very well to me at the moment. My goodness, he's a drama queen. Yesterday, after I wrote to you, I had an attack of asthma and incessant running at the nose, which obliged me to walk all doubled up and light anti-asthma cigarettes at every tobacconist's I passed. And what's worse, I haven't been able to get to bed till midnight after endless fumigations, and it's 3 or 4 hours after a real summer attack, an unheard of thing for me. But he discovered the asthma cigarette and he just became absolutely hooked on them.
Which tends to happen. So what we've got is generations of different treatments, contraptions, trying to deal with asthma. In reality, none of them are ideal. And that brings us to a kitchen
In Los Angeles in 1955, when a moment happened that no one saw it coming, Daniel, what happens on the morning of April 5th, 1955?
So in the kitchen is Dr. George Mason, and he's the president of a company called Ryker Labs. And they're a subsidiary of a company that makes beauty products and pharmaceutical products. And one of their big selling products is hairspray. And sitting next to him is Susie, his teenage daughter. And she's a Los Angeles high schooler. She's 13 years old and she has really bad asthma. And she is absolutely sick and tired of this cumbersome steampunk looking glass nebulizer that she has to take to school with her. She has refrigerated vials of medicine. And every time she has an attack coming on, they have to get the vial, put it in the thing, put the water in there. And she has to sit there for ages breathing on it. And it's really crimping her style at school. And she just absolutely hates it. And the thing breaks. Her dad's sick and tired of having to get these refrigerated vials all the time. And being the 1950s, hairspray is really popular and aerosol cans are the great new invention that everyone loves. And Susie looks at her dad and says, "Why can't you just put my asthma medication in an aerosol can like you do hairspray?" And he says, "You know, that's not a bad idea."
So after Susie's brainwave over breakfast, her dad, George, goes to work and he asks his team of scientists and chemists whether this idea of an asthma aerosol treatment could actually work.
And in the lab there are three guys, and the head of the lab is this guy, Irving Purish. Now, Irving was a chemist who'd previously worked at the Coca-Cola bottling plant, and he's now working making these little glass vials of asthma medication. And working with him is a young chemist, Charlie Teal, who's fresh-faced, he's just arrived on the job, and George comes to see them. And, you know, he gives them this challenge. "I'm going to give you a couple of weeks. I want you to see if you can figure out a way to put the asthma medication into an aerosol can."
And you can almost see the light bulb going off over Irving's head. He immediately thinks, "Guys, we need to go talk to the hairspray people."
Down the corridor at the company, there's a big laboratory full of people who make all their very profitable hairspray products. So he goes down the corridor to talk to these guys and says, "Okay, how do you put stuff in an aerosol can?" And they tell him about their secret, which is this amazing thing called Freon, chlorofluorocarbon propellant. And that's the secret that makes it work.
So they've got the secret ingredient. Now they need to figure out how to get the asthma medication into the propellant.
So the way that it works is you've got this odourless, colourless, tasteless, non-toxic liquid, this propellant, and it needs to be compressed under pressure in order to be a liquid. You mix up the chemical in it and then you spray it through a small hole and it boils away to a gas and makes little droplets. That's how an aerosol can works. This is difficult because you've got to do it under pressure, and it's also difficult to do because the asthma medication will not dissolve in the propellant. It just sinks to the bottom. And so they've got these two problems they have to solve. The bottling problem, Irving already knows how to solve this. He realizes, wait, Coca-Cola bottles can hold a lot of pressure before they burst. Why don't we just make up the medicine in a Coke bottle? So on the weekend, he goes and buys a case of clean, fresh, empty soda bottles. He goes and gets a bottle capping machine. And on Monday morning, the next week, he brings it into the lab. And they start filling soda bottles with asthma medicine and propellant.
The next problem they have to solve is how to dissolve the medicine to make sure that there's a good dose when somebody actually inhales. It turns out that the medicine doesn't dissolve in the propellant, but it does dissolve in alcohol.
So they do a bit of clever chemistry and they figure out that if they get just the right ratios of the alcohol and the propellant and mix them together, they can make a stable product. And they are able to successfully make it in the Coca-Cola bottle. And then the challenge is, how do they actually dispense it? Because a normal aerosol can nozzle won't work. You need to have a very precise dose in order to be able to deliver the drug to the lungs. It's got to be a fine aerosol, and it's got to be just the right amount. Not too little and not too much.
Luckily for them, though, there is a new product that perfectly solves this problem for them.
At the same time, this guy, Philip Meshberg, who worked for a completely different company, he was making perfume sprayers, little perfume dispensers. And he'd invented a little bottle and a little valve that would give you just the right amount of perfume with every squirt. Because we all know that no one likes it when someone has too much cologne or perfume. You've got to have just the right amount. And so Irving and his team were able to get the patent, pay a fee, and use the valve. And in doing so, they invented the world's first asthma puffer.
So how did it go when they tested it?
So when you invent a new medicine, it typically takes a really long time for it to go from the lab to the pharmacy, because we have to do all these clinical trials and tests to make sure that it's safe. And usually these things can take years, typically 10 years. This was amazing. They managed to make this thing work in 2 months. So just 2 months in the lab, they got it to work. They sent it off to the Food and Drug Administration, which is the government regulator in the United States that approves pharmaceutical products for sale. And within less than a year, by March 1956, so about a year later, it's being sold, which is just record time. It was so far ahead of any other asthma medication at that time that people couldn't believe how good it is. And they were so excited to get it out for sale.
So in terms of the scale of this invention, how significant do you think it was?
These days, about 500 million inhalers are sold per year. In America alone, about 25 million people have asthma. Pretty much all of them use an inhaler. And in Australia, it's about 2.8 to 3 million people have asthma. And in Australia, we sell about 25 million inhalers a year. So we do not know how many lives Irving and George and Charlie and their team saved with this invention, because the breakthrough with the portable asthma inhaler is that if you get an asthma attack, you can self-administer the medication to relieve the symptoms on the spot before the ambulance arrives. So you can do your own first aid, basically. And this completely changes the game. It improves the quality of life for asthma sufferers all over the world. And we will never know how many lives these guys saved.
Now, it may sound like it, but this isn't actually the end of our story, because there's a twist that comes a couple of decades later. And it has to do with that wonder chemical that made aerosol cans and puffers work, which is CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. Try saying that 10 times fast. So what actually happens with CFCs?
So these days we know that CFCs are really bad for the ozone layer. But back when they invented the asthma inhaler, they didn't know this. It was discovered in 1974, so almost 20 years later, that when these chlorofluorocarbons are emitted into the atmosphere, so you use your asthma inhaler or your aerosol can and it goes up into the sky, the ultraviolet rays from the sun, they break these chlorofluorocarbon molecules apart, and the ultraviolet radiation can break off the chlorine. And when it does, it reacts with hundreds and hundreds of these ozone molecules in the upper atmosphere. And over years, it just eats away the ozone layer.
Yeah, so that's a problem. In 1987, the Montreal Protocol was signed, which was this international environmental agreement to phase out the use of certain man-made chemicals, including the one used in the puffer.
And this creates a problem for the pharmaceutical industry, because what it means is if we stop using chlorofluorocarbons in fridges, freezers, air conditioners, aerosol cans, if they stop making it, they have to find a replacement product for the inhalers.
And that, as you can imagine, is no small feat, because they had to solve the problem all over again of how to dissolve the drug, make it stable and safe for human consumption.
And what they replaced them with was hydrofluorocarbons. And hydrofluorocarbons are refrigerants just like CFCs, but they don't have the chlorine. So they don't damage the ozone layer, which is great. But as we tend to do as humans, we just replaced one problem with another problem. And the problem that we created was that the hydrofluorocarbons are shockingly bad greenhouse gases.
Yeah, you can see where that one's going, can't you? So the HFCs, they had to be gradually phased out as well and replaced with another effective, safe alternative. And this is where Daniel fits into the story.
So I lead a team of about 7 scientists at Monash University, and we're working with a company called Kindeva Drug Delivery, which is actually the descendant of 3M Pharmaceuticals, which is the descendant of Ryker Laboratories, the original creators of the inhaler. And we are developing new formulations and new designs for the inhaler that allow us to use propellants that don't have a strong greenhouse warming effect. And it's quite tricky to do because when you change the chemistry of the product, it changes the size of the droplets and the delivery of the dosage, and we have to very precisely understand these things. So what my lab does is we do very detailed laser and X-ray based measurements of the sprays and what's going on inside the inhaler in order to understand how this will affect the performance of the device, and we can come up with new designs that allow us to use these more environmentally friendly propellants. And the hope is that in the next sort of 5 to 10 years, we'll be able to replace the existing ones with the new ones. And from the perspective of someone going to the pharmacy to buy their asthma puffer, you won't notice any difference. And if no one notices the difference, we've done our job.
Now, you may be wondering right now, how much do asthma puffers actually contribute to greenhouse gases anyway? Well, as it turns out, not that much.
It's really tiny. So hydrofluorocarbons are only about 2% of all the greenhouse gas we emit. But for the inhalers, I mean, it's only a fraction of a hundredth of a percent. It's tiny. So the actual greenhouse emissions from an asthma puffer are really small. But the problem is that, again, if we stop using hydrofluorocarbons for fridges and freezers and air conditioners, and that's kind of already happened. If you go and buy a fridge or freezer or an air conditioner and you look at the sticker on it that says what chemicals in it, they won't have hydrofluorocarbon anymore. It'll be something more environmentally friendly, like isopentane or carbon dioxide. And so as the market shrinks, the companies that make these chemicals are just not making as much of it anymore. And so the pharma companies have to switch to something else because the market's disappearing. A whole lot of new technologies have come on the market over the last few decades. Dry powder inhalers, soft mist inhalers, new different types of medication delivery devices that don't use any propellants at all. And so with a combination of all of these, we're hopefully going to soon be at a point where the greenhouse footprint of inhalers is just much, much less than it used to be.
God, it's an incredible journey, isn't it? From a kitchen table and a 13-year-old girl to a team of researchers here in Australia. It's quite epic when you think about it in those terms.
Yeah, and it's really interesting for me because I'm kind of the scientifically, like the grandchild of a guy like Charlie Teal. So Charlie was the sort of mentor for one of the senior scientists, Stephen, at the company that we're working with. And Stephen teaches me, mentors me. And so it's sort of this, you know, we have this scientific lineage and we're just carrying on solving one problem after another.
Did you ever get a chance to meet any of the original inhaler inventors like your Charlie Teals?
So I did meet Charlie very briefly once. I was at a conference in Arizona and he was there to hand out an award that was being named after him. It was the last time he ever came to a scientific conference. He passed away shortly afterwards. And I was a young scientist at the time, so I was just, you know, dumbstruck. I didn't have anything to say. But I was in his presence for a short time, which was very special.
Now, we should reveal, in addition to the incredible work you do and what a wonderful storyteller you are actually a No One Saw It Coming listener. You wrote us, that thing I ask people to do at the end of every episode, you wrote in and said, this is a tale worth telling. What made you do that beyond me just asking you repeatedly every week?
So the thing about the invention of the asthma puffer is almost no one knows about it. And when I go to scientific conferences and we talk to other scientists and pharmaceutical engineers and pharmacologists about all the work that we're doing to develop new asthma inhalers and drug delivery products, there's this apocryphal story that floats around that often comes up at the conference dinners, and people talk about this, about little 13-year-old Susie and how her question created our entire industry sector. And all of the work that we do today would never have happened if it weren't for that one moment at the kitchen table. And this story fascinated me and I had to read more about it. And it just occurred to me that when I was listening to your show, this is a No One Saw It Coming moment. People need to know about this.
Well said. Daniel, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thanks, Mark.
Dr. Daniel Duke is a senior lecturer in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Monash University. Should also note, he does receive funding from the Australian Research Council and Kindeva Drug Delivery for his research. Now, if you happen to be listening to this podcast, just like Daniel was, and thinking, I have a thing that no one saw coming that the world needs to know about, just write to us. No one saw it coming at abc.net.au. This episode was produced by Taryn Priadko and Zoe Ferguson on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. The sound design was by Angie Grant. And as always, if you enjoyed the episode, actually, maybe you're a person that uses a puffer and now you know more about how it came to be, share it with somebody else who maybe uses a puffer and let them know as well. My name is Mark Fennell and I will be back with a brand new episode of No One Saw It Coming next week. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.